The clash between natural gas drilling interests in Pennsylvania and private property owners continues to play out. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Let's head out to a maple farm in New Milford, Pennsylvania. That's where we find State Impact Pennsylvania reporter John Hurdle. John, thanks for joining us again on NewsWorks Tonight.
Hi, Dave.
I understand there was an active protest until late in the day today. What's the protest about?
Well, there were around about 20 people here at this very remote location, which is about 30 miles north of Scranton. And the folks here are unhappy that a land is being cleared in order to make way for an interstate pipeline, which is scheduled to be built to take natural gas from the Marcellus Shale in Susquehanna County here into New York State.
We're talking about eminent domain. Describe that term and how it's playing out here.
Eminent domain is the process by which an operator such as the Williams Companies and Cabot Oil and Gas, who jointly own the proposed Constitution pipeline, can actually move into private land if landowners do not agree to the compensation terms. And the family in question, the landowners in question, who own about 23 acres here, in Susquehanna County, lost an eminent domain action in federal court in Scranton about a year ago, and as a result of which, the company has the right to move in. And there have been various arguments in the intervening year, but today the trees actually fell, and there are approximately an acre and a half of trees that have been cut today, a short distance from where I'm standing, and I'm told that about the same amount is due to be cut again tomorrow. And the operators of the woodland here, the Holleran family, who owned the plot since the 1950s, harvest maple syrup from these trees, and they say that their maple syrup operation has now been destroyed as a result of this action.
John, describe the scene, though, earlier today, the juxtaposition between these landowners, in this case the owners of the maple farm, and apparently state troopers staring them down.
You could probably describe it as kind of an uneasy standoff. When I arrived here at around about 3 o'clock this afternoon, there were around about, 15 or 20 protesters, but they were a significant distance away. They were probably 200 or 300 feet away from where the chainsaws were actually operating. The tree-cutting crews were being protected by a number of U.S. marshals who were armed with semi-automatic weapons and who were wearing bulletproof vests.
Tell us about another eminent domain court case playing out, the Mariner East 2 pipeline, Sunoco's line.
There are a number of eminent domain actions that are taking place in connection with the Mariner East 2 pipeline. That proposed pipeline is significantly longer than the Constitution pipeline. Constitution's about 125 miles. The Mariner East pipeline is about 350 miles that is planned to take natural gas liquids from western Pennsylvania to a processing plant at Marcus Hook near Philadelphia.
John, thanks for bringing us up to speed.
You're welcome.
State Impact Pennsylvania's John Hurdle on NewsWorks Tonight. A Pennsylvania grand jury has found that two past leaders of the Altoona Johnstown Roman Catholic Diocese covered up allegations of child sexual abuse at the hands of priests and other clergy. WHYY's Mary Wilson reports.
The grand jury's presentment depicts a diocese that documented hundreds of instances of child abuse by clergy. Priests were reassigned instead of being removed, and past bishops intercepted law enforcement to avoid criminal investigations. No charges are being filed. The crime's statutes of limitations have expired. Some alleged abusers have died, and some victims are unable to testify in court. State Attorney General Kathleen Kane says the grand jury's work exposes the effect of the sexual abuse on one family.
The victim's father found himself dealing with intense feelings of anger and violence, and the victim's mother was treated with medication. The victim himself began to struggle with his faith and abandon his hopes of being a priest.
None of the clergy accused of abuse remain in active ministry, and the grand jury praised the diocese's current bishop for removing accused child molesters. The state's investigation is ongoing. Mary Wilson in Harrisburg.
The diocese has not returned requests for comment. An attorney for the still-living former bishop criticized in the grand jury report says its accusations are unfounded. Law enforcement agencies in Philadelphia are closely monitoring the debate over whether Apple should unlock an iPhone used by a mass killer in San Bernardino. As WHYY's Bobby Allen reports, how the courts decide to balance security versus privacy could affect several criminal investigations underway in Philadelphia.
In the fall of 2014, Apple made a big switch. Encryption went from optional to the default on its iPhones. Reports indicate that criminals are now doing business on the newer phones, knowing that they have protection. I asked Police Commissioner Richard Ross if crooks in Philadelphia are following suit.
Certainly, it's a reality that they have, and right now it just seems to be something in their favor.
Does he think the bad guys who use the phones have an edge?
I think they do, and particularly those who might be trying to do things of a terrorist nature.
It's a concern echoed by law enforcement officials around the country. Since local police and prosecutors handle the vast majority of crimes, a determination in the San Bernardino case will have a trickle effect nearly everywhere. Authorities in Los Angeles say they have more than 400 phones they can't crack connected to crimes. New York City's DA says it has more than 200. Philly prosecutors declined to say how many locked phones they have in evidence lockers. But Temple Law professor Duncan Hollis says city police and prosecutors are putting many cases on hold until they know what the rules are.
Where do you say, you know, we want you to investigate crimes, but we don't want you to be on everybody's phone, you know, Big Brother, watching everyone all the time?
He says the last so-called crypto war in the 1990s between the telecommunications industry and the federal government was resolved with an act of Congress. Since then, phone companies have to let the feds wiretap phones when there's a search warrant. Hollis is left hopeful about a law that would regulate encryption, but possibly next year after the election frenzy. If Congress does decide to do something, the ACLU's Aisha Bendari says it needs to favor privacy. She says police already have lots of data on who we're talking to, where we travel, and other activity, leaving a digital trail.
And the push for encryption has been in part driven by a sense that people want to regain some of that balance and some of that control over their private data that has been lost in the current digital environment.
City law enforcement officials say digital evidence plays a huge role in tracking down murderers, rapists, and thieves, and that data is secured only through court orders and subpoenas. But privacy advocates like Bendari ask, should private companies like Apple really be working at the behest of police to serve as surveillance agents? Until it's all cleared up, all the locked phones in the custody of Philadelphia authorities will remain that way. For WHYY News, I'm Bobby Allen.
The fight over security only underscores our reliance on electronic devices. But at Pennsylvania's Department of Environmental Protection, it's a struggle just to keep up with modern technology. State Impact Pennsylvania's Marie Cusick has more on the effort to bring the agency into the 21st century.
Remember those early commercials for Apple's iPhone?
Yep, there's an app for just about anything.
Nearly a decade later, DEP staff is just now getting permission to add apps to their government-issued iPhones. This is good news for Scott Perry, who heads the agency's Oil and Gas Bureau.
So our folks could put decibel meters on their phones and understand if they're dealing with a noise problem.
From his office on the top floor of the Rachel Carson Building in Harrisburg, he sees more positive changes on the horizon.
We're looking at putting in Wi-Fi in this building. We do not have Wi-Fi.
Why don't they have it yet?
Nobody ever wanted it before.
That's DEP Secretary John Quigley.
There has been such a turning away from technology over the last decade in the agency because of budget cuts, just relentless year after year of budget cuts.
With us today is the Honorable Secretary John Quigley. John, thank you
very
much.
At a recent budget hearing, he told legislators the department has a major problem with internet bandwidth at its 6 regional offices around the state.
It takes minutes, sometimes hours, for web pages to load, if they load at all. Just horrendously slow internet service. We're in the process of fixing that. That will probably save employees about an hour a day on average.
Republican Senator Scott Wagner of York County was not happy to hear that. He told Quigley the department should throw its weight around, literally.
You mentioned about the internet side. Have you slapped your provider around? I mean,
we're about to.
Well, I'd be happy to come over and slap them around.
Republican Senator Bob Mensch of Berks County agreed the DEP was stuck in the technological past.
Yeah, I was on a conference call the other day with one of your locations, and we had a speakerphone on, and I actually heard a dial-up modem.
Yeah. Remember this sound?
And in 2004, that was obsolete, let alone in 2016. So I feel your pain to that extent.
The lack of investment in IT means the private sector is light years ahead of regulators. For example, the gas industry trade group, the Marcellus Shale Coalition, built a database a few years ago for water quality data. It's made up of what's known as pre-drill or baseline test results. It's critical information that helps establish whether gas activity could have contaminated a water supply. The DEP stores that same information in a much less useful way. As Scott Perry explains, the data is in PDF documents on CDs.
To transition to something different means we need additional resources.
The gas industry allows the DEP to access its database, but Perry says it doesn't have the functionality he'd like. He's hopeful the department can eventually build its own database to analyze the information more quickly.
It really ought not to come to as a surprise to many people that companies like Shell and Exxon and Chevron have a larger capital budget than most countries, let alone the Department of Environmental Protection.
Meanwhile, the department has purchased nearly 150 tablet computers so inspectors can ditch the paper. Quigley says their productivity could double.
This is the year they get iPads.
But those iPads will still need solid internet connections. The agency's working on it. Marie Cusick, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
Turning to this evening's headlines, New Jersey's Senate president is not taking down the roadblock for Governor Chris Christie's Supreme Court nominee. Democrat Steve Sweeney says Superior Court Judge David Baumann will not get a hearing, and the only way he'd consider a Christie nominee is if the governor submits a Democrat for the court. Sweeney says he's fought for 6 years to protect a long-standing tradition of keeping political balance on New Jersey's Supreme Court, noting that Baumann's nomination would leave two Democrats on the seven-member court. Bill Cosby's preliminary hearing in a criminal sex assault case is on hold, while a Pennsylvania appeals court considers his effort to have the case thrown out before trial. The Pennsylvania Superior Court took that action today, while the court weighs the prosecution request to shut down Cosby's pretrial appeal. Cosby is accused of drugging and molesting a Temple University employee in his suburban Philadelphia home in 2004. Partly cloudy, 52 degrees at 6:19. You're listening to Newsworks Tonight on WHYY. Showers, maybe even a thunderstorm overnight into early tomorrow morning. Temperatures holding steady. Still ahead, after 56 years, the Society Hill Playhouse will close its doors, but not without a last hurrah.
The show is sort of done as a tribute to this theater. It's we wanted it to go out with a great show and with something that was funny and something that would allow people to recognize the value of this theater.
Newsworks Tonight continues on WHYY.
Support for WHYY comes from the Rutgers Camden Professional MBA and Professional Masters in Accounting programs, cohort-based accelerated degree programs designed for working professionals with classes held on Saturdays in Princeton. The next cohort begins this fall. An information session is on Tuesday, March 15th at 6 p.m. at the Crown Plaza, Princeton. pmba.rutgers.edu or 856-225-2700. The Rutgers Camden Professional Degree Programs. Expect more. Be more.
Guided by Quaker values, Folkways at Gwinnett, a continuing care retirement community for active adults 65 and over since 1967, supports WHYY. Folkways provides residents with proven financial stability, a comprehensive health care program, and a community where friendship, caring, dignity, and respect are a way of life. Select apartments highlighting their newest design features are now available. To discover Folkways Retirement Community and to arrange for a personal tour, 215-283-7010. 215-283-7010.
Welcome back to Newsworks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. A landmark of Philadelphia's theater scene will soon go dark. The Society Hill Playhouse, which has been run by the same owners for 56 years, is slated for demolition next month. From WHYY's Arts and Culture Desk, Peter Crimmins reports that the theater at 8th and South Streets will have its final performance this weekend.
The Society Hill Playhouse will close with a debut. The first play by a new company called Liberty City Radio Theater will shut down the stage.
I'm crazy for feeling so lonely.
The play is a series of three radio dramas performed live on stage with musical interludes. Two stories were written for radio in the 30s. A third is an original radio mystery by producer Bill Arrowood. He wrote it with this theater in mind.
The show is sort of done as a tribute to this theater. We wanted it to go out with a great show and with something that was funny and something that would allow people to recognize the value of this theater in the history of Philadelphia drama.
The Society Hill Playhouse was bought in 1959 by Jay and Dean Cogan when they were fresh out of college. They were determined to bring the avant-garde to Philadelphia, premiering new plays by James Joyce, Gunter Grass, and Bertolt Brecht.
New work by contemporary playwrights. Part of the mission also was to involve the communities, people who maybe didn't go to theater.
That is Dean Cogan. She says the theater was racially integrated and mobile. For a short time, actors went out into the neighborhoods performing in the back of a flatbed truck. 25 years in, the Cogans happened upon a musical comedy performed in a small New York theater. It was a farce called Nonsense, which Dean dismissed as what she calls a ladies' musical.
Miss Know-It-All here said to my husband, well, I guess we could get 5 weeks out of it. And it ran 10 years.
Because Nonsense dominated their stage so long, the Cogans built a smaller cabaret theater downstairs where they could continue to program edgier stuff. Jay Cogan died in 1993. Dean kept the theater going for decades until last year. The Toll Brothers, the development company, offered to buy the building, demolish it, and build condos. After 56 years, it was an offer Dean couldn't refuse.
The fiscal challenges are heavier. This is not a social theater. I never went for a law firm to underwrite the play. And getting funding is much harder now. I have reached a point where I don't want to bother.
The Playhouse's papers will be archived at Temple University. That's where the Cogans studied. Some pieces of the theater will be warehoused by the Philadelphia History Museum, and other items will be sold at an indoor yard sale on March 13th. I'm Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
Heaven, I'm in heaven. Then my heart beats so that I...
As personal taunts increasingly drown out discussion about substantive issues in the ramp-up to Super Tuesday presidential primaries, let's look at the legacy of dirty tricks tactics with New York University history professor Jonathan Zimmerman. Jonathan, welcome back to Newsworks Tonight.
Good to be here as always.
Jonathan, seems like there's an inherent tension. Voters, of course, want to learn about the candidate's character and stance on the problems and challenges facing the nation. Candidates, well, they want to win, often by diverting attention from their past statements and voting record. So what qualifies as a dirty trick, and when did it first gain traction in campaigns?
Well, I think a dirty trick is somehow underhanded or involves subterfuge. And we've had a couple examples recently from the Ted Cruz campaign. In one example, he had staffers call people in Iowa and tell them that Ben Carson, another GOP candidate, was dropping out, which he wasn't. And then his campaign also circulated a video in which Marco Rubio, another GOP candidate, seemed to say to somebody on the campaign trail that the Bible doesn't have all the answers. In fact, he was saying the opposite, that it does. But the point is, it was underhanded of Cruz's operatives to send that around. And indeed, Cruz admitted so and fired his communication director for it.
Where, though, on the ranking does that lie in comparison to telling semi-truths or outright lies?
Well, look, there's a long history of that as well. And often those semi-truths and outright lies are told via, again, an operative, somebody down the chain, not by the candidate. So a very good example is Franklin Roosevelt, who actually instructed his staff to spread rumors about extramarital affairs involving Wendell Willkie, his challenger in 1940. Now, this is ironic for a million reasons, one of which is that, of course, Roosevelt had his own longstanding extramarital affair.
I'm wondering, though, through time, is the practice becoming more prevalent? And paradoxically, with the advent of Internet and organizations like Fact Check and Committee of 70, you might think a candidate could get caught earlier and sooner.
Well, I think that's what happened in the case of Cruz in this video. You know, they picked it up, ironically, from the Daily Pennsylvanian, from Penn student newspaper, which had first posted it on the net. And without the internet, we would have never had this Marco Rubio video controversy because nobody would have seen it. In earlier eras, there were actual specialists in dirty tricks pre-internet, you know, people who came up with them in very creative ways. The Democrats' most famous dirty trickster was a guy named Dick Tuck, who was a Californian and very much a thorn in the side of another Dick, i.e. Dick Nixon. And Tuck planted all kinds of, in retrospect, rather humorous tricks against Nixon. In 1960, when Nixon was running for president against JFK, Dick Tuck himself posed as a train conductor during one of Nixon's whistle stop tours. And as the conductor, before Nixon could address the crowd, the train had stopped, he said to the engineer, "Okay, let's move on out." And they just left the crowd there because everyone thought Dick Tuck was a conductor and it was time to leave.
Have studies emerged determining whether dirty tricks are likely to succeed or backfire?
To me, the larger point is what's dirty and isn't is in some ways in the eye of the beholder. So when Dick Tuck posed as a conductor and made the Nixon train leave early, I think to a lot of people watching, especially Democrats and even some Republicans, this was more of a prank than a dirty joke. I think that when Cruz had his staffers tell people that Carson had withdrawn when he hadn't, I think that because that was more explicitly dishonest and also in a way more targeted towards the election itself, you know, who's running and who isn't, I think probably a lot of people interpreted it as perhaps dirtier than funny.
Thanks, Jonathan.
Thanks. It was fun.
That's New York University history professor Jonathan Zimmerman. Finally this evening, we're still a few weeks out from the official change of season, but spring cleaning is already underway along the Schuylkill River. The Schuylkill Scrub, a massive cleanup campaign throughout the Schuylkill River Valley, started today. Now for Sean Bailey, communications director for the Partnership for the Delaware River Estuary, the cleanup is a way to address the litter problem, and it's meant to convey what can be done to improve the overall health of those interconnected waterways.
A funny thing happens when people get together and get to talking about the river. They become educated.
The Scrub runs through the end of May. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov and Kimberly Haas. Find us on iTunes or listen back at newsworks.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.
Proudly supporting WHYY, Camp Hill Special School, an accredited Waldorf school with day and boarding options dedicated to redefining what is possible for children and youth with special needs. Students not only study visual arts, music, and crafts, but contribute to the community as a whole by taking part in festivals, caring for animals, participating on student council, and fulfilling meaningful roles in their on-campus homes. Offering campus tours on March 16th and April 20th at 9 a.m. Details at CampHillSpecialSchool.org.
People's Light presents Jane Austen's Sense and Sensibility, February 10th through March 20th. Full of passion, wit, and soaring emotions, the penniless Dashwood sisters pursue life and love in their own distinctive ways. Eleanor is smart and down-to-earth, while Marianne is wildly romantic. They each attract suitors whose startling secrets obstruct the path to happily ever after. For tickets, peopleslight.org or 610-644-3500. People's Light supports WHYY.